North Korea. See, now we're having a conversation. It's impossible to bring up North Korea without getting into a conversation. And with good reason. The guy who runs the place is like a James Bond supervillain. If he lived in a volcano with silver-suited henchmen, it wouldn't be any weirder than anything else we've heard about the People's Republic of North Korea and its eminently newsworthy leader. But give Kim Jong-un credit. He knows how to make Americans nervous. The question is, do we really need to be? For this episode of Convo, I'm talking with Dr. Richard Stoll. He's the Albert Thomas Professor of Political Science at Rice University in Houston, and he also certainly knows a thing or two about North Korea. Dr. Stoll, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start out with a bit of a softball here. One of the things about North Korea, I think, is that we find it so just entertaining. We hear the craziest stuff about North Korea and about Kim Jong-un and really the whole Kim dynasty from the beginning. We've heard just some crazy, crazy stuff sometimes. And we kind of bought it that the guy eats sawdust for its nutrients or whatever. He doesn't have to go to the bathroom or, you know, these kind of crazy things we hear about the guy. And yet we always seem to go with it for some reason. We always just seem to kind of buy right in from the beginning. How do you think we're always taken in by some what seems to be such cartoony propaganda about North Korea? What is the charm here?
I think at heart it's because they, and this has been going on for a long time, they threaten our friends in the region, and possibly now with their nuclear program and ballistic missile program, threaten us. I think if they didn't possess the ability to threaten countries, I don't think we pay any attention to what's going on there.
Do you think it's dangerous for us in a way to find Kim so entertaining, or is it sort of background noise to you when you hear things like this?
Well, it's fine for people who are just observing to say, well, look at the crazy things this guy said. But of course, what we depend on is the people in our government taking them very seriously and figuring out what's the best way to act against them. And I'm fairly confident that the people in the government, this administration and previous administrations, do take this seriously. So it's okay for us to get a little laugh or two, as long as the people that are paid to pay attention do the right thing.
Well, they certainly do seem to be paying attention these days. If you're following Twitter or anything, it does especially seem as if the president and the administration are definitely taking him seriously.
Yeah, and again, from my point of view, this Kim Jong-un, it's just a continuation of what we saw with his father and even his grandfather. It's a little different now that they have a nuclear program and a ballistic missile program that has achieved at least some measure of progress. But the kinds of statements he's made, the kinds of actions he's taken, I think are fully consistent with the previous leadership.
I do, too. I don't necessarily think he's any worse myself than anything else I've heard from the other Kims, you know, going back a couple now. It just doesn't seem like he's any worse, except that I do wonder if his age has anything to do with it, because, you know, young people can be kind of impulsive, and I think maybe that might be kind of scary, because, I mean, unlike his father and his grandfather, who actually saw some real legitimate conflict, Kim Jong-un is pretty young. He's not lived through the Korean War itself, and it seems like his only real experience in life has been to be groomed to be, you know, the king, the boy king.
Well, I think there is something to the, you know, the Korean War was a terrible disaster for North Korea. And I think a leadership in that country that actually lived through that might be inclined to be a little more cautious. On the other hand, to me, it's less about his age and more about his experience or lack of experience. When you have a new, and he's been around for a while, so that's presumably less of a problem. When you have a brand new leader who's never done this before come to power, no matter where it is, they don't necessarily understand the limitations that the, you know, if you say something, people will take it at least moderately seriously. And hopefully most leaders kind of grow in their awareness of these things and tend to do a little less crazy stuff.
Do you think that Kim Jong-un and North Korea need to be dealt with harshly? What do you think is a good approach here for as far as how we should be handling this?
I guess personally, I'm not comfortable with the word harsh. I would say firmly, and maybe to other people they don't see a difference. But we need to make clear to the government there, and probably have to repeat this a number of times, that we will protect our friends in the area. And if North Korea should stage an attack against the United States, that would be a disaster for them. Now, you can do this in different ways. My personal preference is to do this sort of quietly through diplomatic channels, working with other countries, rather than just kind of get out in the public and say something. Because if you do that, you risk at least some chance of the leadership there saying, oh yeah, you think you can make us back down? Well, we'll show you. Whereas if you did it in kind of a moderate way, in a quiet way, they might take you more seriously.
Would you say that there is too much saber-rattling going on from our side of the fence? I mean, do you think the president is...
Yeah, I would prefer to keep it at a quieter level on both sides, because, you know, you just... Each side is running at least some risk, perhaps not a very high risk, but some risk that the other side will sort of overreact to one thing that was said, particularly if it's said in public, like, we can't let them say this about us because the world will think we're weak, so we've got to do something dramatic. So, yeah, I would prefer to dial back the rhetoric on both sides.
Well, I did want to ask you something that I think I forwarded you an article that references Dr. Andrei Lonkov. And for listeners unfamiliar with who Dr. Lonkov is, he's the director of the Korea Risk Group that advises and publishes information on North Korea. And he recently gave a talk at Texas A&M, not this campus where I am. He spoke at the mothership down in College Station. And he said something that I found really fascinating, which is that Kim Jong-un is dangerous, but he's not a madman. And he's somebody who's mostly concerned with dying a ripe old age like his father and grandfather, more so than bolstering his country. I'm very curious on your thoughts on that kind of assessment of this guy.
Yeah, I agree. To me, you know, when you say someone is crazy, you mean, you know, there's no rhyme or reason or logic to their actions. I think that in most ways, he's very rational in the sense of he has some goals. In particular, I think his first and most important goal is to remain in power. And he looks around and sees, you know, what are my choices in order to preserve my leadership, in order perhaps to expand the power of North Korea. And then he makes choices based on that. Now, you and I and other people may say, well, he's overweighting the importance of this and underweighting the importance of that. But no, I don't think he's crazy. I think he's fairly rational. He just wants to pursue some things that we don't agree with.
Well, you know, the question about the future is something that always gets me on this, too. And this sort of chews on me. We're as Americans, I think we're great at a great many things, but sort of seeing the deep, long game is not necessarily one of our advantages from, you know, what I can tell in this country. So I admit I'm concerned by how much we're paying attention to North Korea as it exists in the now. You know, I mean, we like to think, like I said at the beginning, it's kind of there's a cartoony quality. You know, he seems like a James Bond supervillain. And to us, he seems a bit of a cartoon. And I think we like to convince ourselves that, say, his missiles don't work, his army is just this small, contained little thing. But that's all now. That might be true now that maybe his ICBMs can't hit us now. But technology does get better. It does get more accurate. It does get longer range. I mean, we started out with bottle rockets and eventually we got to the moon. So it's something that can build. So how concerned are you of North Korea as a legitimate growing threat, say, in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years? Do you see anything evolving that is a bigger problem here?
Well, I think, you know, there's some things to be concerned about, and there's other things that maybe we don't have to worry about quite so much. I think, for example, the bulk of their military is in terrible shape. I mean, there people report when you go to the demilitarized zone, the sort of line that divides North and South Korea, and you observe the North Korean soldiers and the South Korean soldiers, the South Korean soldiers are clearly larger. And so what we're seeing here is the impact of the fact that they can't feed their people in the North. And you know, the military, relative to the general public, has been protected as much as possible, but it's still causing problems. So, and if you look at, they have well over 500 combat aircraft, but most reports suggest that their pilots only get to fly 20 to 30 hours a year, which is not nearly enough to become proficient. They have a large conventional military, but it's not very good. I think we do have to be concerned about the program producing warheads and long-range missiles. Again, depending on the expert that you would consult with, I've seen reports say, well, what they've shown is their missiles can fly up very high, but they haven't demonstrated for certain that they actually have the range to, say, hit targets in the United States. And in terms of the warheads, there's two things, and I don't think we know, well, maybe someone in D.C. with a high security clearance knows, but most of us don't know. One, have they been able to make them small enough so that they can actually put them on a missile, okay? And two, have they been able to build them in a way to withstand the heat and stress of reentry? So it could very well be the case that as we talk today, they don't have the range to hit us. They don't have warheads that will actually work on their missiles today. But there's no question if they choose to pursue these things, they will get them. I can't tell you exactly when, but they have the stuff internally to make these things happen. Now, we and a number of countries have been denying them certain things, and that has slowed them down. But there is no way that we can stop them from moving forward with their missile program and their warhead program. They're just too advanced for us to be able to stop them.
Well, that leads me into another idea here, though. What about the cyber problems that are always attributed to North Korea? I mean, certainly it's a lot cheaper to have a few people just sort of hack away at computers and try to get into the grid over here or break into, you know, there was a North Korean counterfeit money scam that was going on for a while. They made $100 bills that were almost identical to American $100 bills. Do you think are we worried a little too much about this sort of nuclear and or conventional war as opposed to these?
I'm pretty confident that the government as a whole is paying attention to these other things. But let's face it, they're just not, unless there's a particular cyber attack, for example, if they're just sitting around trying a few things, learning better how they can do things, it just doesn't have a lot of visibility. And then, of course, again, at the end of the day, you know, the biggest threat they could potentially pose to us, not today, but in the future, is with their nuclear weapons. So, yeah, again, I'm pretty confident the U.S. government is paying attention to the other kinds of things they've been doing that could hurt us or hurt our friends.
Well, when I did ask you to be on the podcast and you said, could you send me some questions so that you know what to sort of brush up on? And I said, sure. And if there's anything you want me to know, you can let me know. And, you know, the disclosure here, you sent back something that I found very somewhat ominous. I have to admit that the biggest issue is what happens after the war. So do you care to discuss the idea of what happens when the North Koreans, not a matter of if so much, but when they really develop nuclear capabilities, what do you think really is going to happen here, especially with our allies, their allies, the whole world? I mean, how big a deal do you think this gets to be?
The first thing is, however their government goes, if Kim Jong-un gets on a big airplane with a ton of money and gold and goes into exile, if he's killed, if there's a war which North Korea will absolutely lose, however it happens, the first thing we need to understand is rebuilding North Korea, sort of even independent of the damage that, say, a war might do, because they're so backwards, is going to be incredibly expensive. If we look at East Germany, when it was absorbed by West Germany, and in terms of having, as a political scientist, we call the government that used to be in East Germany and the current one in North Korea, we call them autocracies, meaning there's a leadership, but they don't depend on, say, the will of the people. They depend on a smaller number of people being loyal to them and doing things. And East Germany was maybe in the best position possible to transition from a communist government to being part of a democracy. They're certainly more advanced than North Korea is today. They had access to a whole bunch of things from the West, you know, media stuff. So they had some idea of what was happening in the West. And whereas in North Korea, there are ways to get a certain amount of information about what's happening outside of North Korea, but it's very difficult. So East Germany's the best case. Most people would argue that the cost of transitioning what we used to call East Germany into part of a unified Germany was something like $1.9 trillion. I've only seen one estimate for what would happen to North Korea, and I'm not knocking the person who did the estimate, but you know, it would be nice if more people would take a look at this so we could get a little better focus on it. But the estimate I've seen for North Korea is it would cost at least $3 trillion and take at least a decade.
Wow.
Okay, again, independent of how the government goes. So it's going to be incredibly costly. And there's another issue which I think doesn't get recognized enough. And I'm going to go back to East Germany to illustrate this, if I could. I was over in Berlin in 1991. That is shortly after the fall of the communist government and the reabsorption of East Germany into a now unified Germany, doing some research with a friend. And his girlfriend was fairly high up in one of the main West German banks. And there's, I don't know, six, seven, eight main West German banks at the time. And I asked her how the transition went. And she said, well, we, the West German banks, absorbed the East German bank system, which absolutely needed to be done. And she said, now we had to teach them how to do real banking. And real banking is not, oh, that's the son of the party boss. He gets everything he wants. Real banking is what you and I deal with if we go try to get a loan, for example. And she said that for the young people, let's say those who had graduated from college maybe 10 years or less, they got it. The East Germans got it. Okay, we understand how we're supposed to do our jobs now, fine. But the managers, who were, of course, more senior and older, she said they never got it. She said, we tried everything we could think of to explain real banking to them. It did not work. And finally, her bank told the managers from the former East German branches, here's what you do. You come to work every day with a lunch and a book, sit in your office and close the door. So they kind of pensioned them off. But they're in North Korea, if the government changes, let's say, and becomes something more democratic, there's going to be generations of people who grew up under the current system who are frankly highly unlikely to be able to adapt to the new system. So that's another thing that would make it very, very difficult to transition them.
Well, that is normal, I think, when it comes to any kind of change of an old system to a new. You have the old dogs who get stuck in an old system. They've lived their entire life in this older system, and then suddenly they have to adjust to it. But that also leads me into thinking about the hearts and minds of the people themselves. I mean, we're not talking about a group of people who are in any way up on how the rest of the world really is going. So it's not just a matter of getting the leadership to do, say, new banking or, you know, restructuring how their military or government works. How hard do you think it is to actually get through to the very people who are going to be in North Korea? Do you think they're just going to go along with everything, or do you think people...
I think a number of them will, for a couple of reasons. One, that's how they've always had to behave. The government tells them what to do. And if they defy the government, there are potentially serious costs. Now, I don't think you'd see the serious cost under a new government, but, you know, the people are used to the old system. So I think that part would go okay. They would still need things like a story from the transitioning of the Soviet Union to something more like a market economy. Under the Soviet system, there were a lot of collective farms. So, you know, there were these gigantic operations, and individual farmers, in a sense, were just part of the collective. And when Yeltsin came to power, someone who had been in exile in Siberia came back. He had run one of these big farms, and he said to called in all the farmers and said, okay, here's the deal. You guys can use all the equipment that we have here that we've been controlling centrally, but you basically are all going to sort of manage your own farmland, okay? And you can go off and sell it, whatever you raise for whatever, you know, money you think you can get, et cetera, et cetera. So we'll help a little bit, but basically you're on your own. And a whole bunch of the farmers said, but what do we do if there's not enough rain for our crops? You know, they were used to a system where they got paid, it wasn't that much, but they got paid no matter what. And now they're being told it's entirely up to you, okay? So I think if you have a big change in North Korea, you're going to need a lot of money, but you're also going to need to have a lot of people go there who know how to do these things in a different political and economic system to help these folks out. And I just wonder if we're ready to do that. When I say we, I'm not talking about the U.S. exclusively, whether the world is ready to do that. And so I, for example, believe that neither China nor South Korea wants to have to absorb North Korea for the reasons we've been talking about. I think their preference, they can't make it happen, and it may never happen, is for the government there to transition by itself, whether it's the same leadership or a different leadership, to something more reasonable. And they're willing to pitch in a certain amount of money and things like that, because they know if they don't, they're going to have a whole bunch of North Koreans fleeing across their borders. So I don't think either South Korea or China wants to take on entirely the task of, quote-unquote, reforming North Korea. I think they would prefer the North Koreans to reform themselves.
Do you see any parallels in terms of what you're worried about, say, from when the Soviet Union dissolved and it became, you know, the different former Soviet republic states? A lot of organized crime happened and sort of the power vacuum that happened. Or when you look at, say, Iraq, and how that quagmire in the Middle East just never really got resolved. And every time we try to sort of pull ourselves out of Iraq now, we can't seem to go. Do you see anything like that happening?
It could. I mean, in part, you could see the issues with whether it's organized crime or whether it's just a relatively small group of people within North Korea sort of takes over big chunks of it in one way or another, not necessarily physically occupying it, but sort of you don't really have a democracy. You have a handful of strong people. On the other hand, a number of things that happened when the Soviet Union broke up were based on ethnic issues. That sort of defined the different parts that broke away, et cetera, et cetera. That part of it, I don't see happening in North Korea. But yeah, you could very well have a small, compared to the size of the population, group of people that sort of set themselves up as semi-corrupt leaders in various chunks of the country. And it's not clear to me how you can prevent that from happening.
Well, okay, so let's talk about China. Let's talk about the geopolitics, which obviously are kind of complicated. Despite the fact that we overwhelmingly in this country do have the military advantage and the money advantage and everything else, we can't just walk in and drop the hammer on this guy like we could on, say, Manuel Noriega or even Saddam Hussein. There's a lot of repercussions and implications that come from this, and a lot of them center on China. So let's talk China. I mean, they're not stupid, but they don't seem to be liking Kim's antics a lot lately. So
So first of all, I don't think China wants to see a North Korea, whether it's a separate country with a different government from what they have now, or whether they get absorbed by South Korea. I don't think they want what would then amount to a Western-oriented country on their border. I think they would resist that. Now, I'm not quite sure, you know, I'm sure they'd say, don't do this. You know, let's suppose a war starts, North Korea starts the war. They understand that South Korea and the United States are going to respond, but it's like, we don't want you to take over this country. So I think that's a problem for them. But if you look, again, through the years, this is not just with the current leadership. They have been trying to get North Korea to change its behavior. For years, they have told them to do what we, i.e. China, did, which is loosen up the economy, put in something like a free market economy, that will bring you prosperity, but keep control of the political system, which is exactly what's happened in China, and clearly they've achieved tremendous economic growth. They've been telling the leadership in North Korea for years and years to do this. Obviously, they've had no impact on that. I think China has not done absolutely everything it could to try to pressure North Korea, but it has done a number of things. And I think China, for example, does not want to see North Korea develop nuclear weapons any further, does not want to see them develop long-range missiles, because they are just afraid of what the consequences are. So if these programs continue, it puts a lot of pressure, for example, both on the governments of South Korea and Japan to start developing their own nuclear programs. And I don't think China sees that as a good thing. So I don't think where China wants to see North Korea go is a lot different from, say, what South Korea wants, what Japan wants, what the United States wants. Do they have more influence than any of those other countries I just named? And the answer is yes. However, I don't think they have as much influence, even if they cranked up the pressure, as some people think. I think, for example, the nuclear program is very, very important to the current leadership. And I find it hard to believe that anybody or collection of countries is going to be able to get them to get rid of it. Maybe you can freeze it at the current level, but I think it's just too important. And I guess my favorite illustration of, you may think China could just snap its fingers and make people happen. 2006, the Chinese were sending food and fuel to North Korea because, as is often the case, North Korea couldn't feed its people. It didn't have enough power generation capability, so China was sending them food and fuel. And they were sending them on trains because that's the most efficient way to get them from China to North Korea. Again, 2006, previous leadership. North Korea was keeping the trains. Okay?
<Yeah.
laughs> So this large, powerful China that, you know, just has to snap its fingers and North Korea will just do whatever it wants, I think that's a myth. And again, this was the current, not the current leadership, but the previous leadership. But can you imagine that? I mean, I think they gave them back, but basically there's a period of time where their trains come into the station, North Korean army gets on the trains, tells the crew, okay, you can leave and go back home, but we're keeping the trains.
That's a little gangster, I have to admit.
One
of the other things I think, though, is it's not so much that, at least here in America, I don't think that we are so much concerned with how much influence China has per se as how much of an ally is China if we were to get into a scrape with North Korea, because China is not a lightweight to be trifled with just willy-nilly. You know, they're not somebody we can just walk right over. I mean, how much of a threat, I guess, militarily or economically would China be on us? What could they really do if there was a conflict that broke out?
Well, you know, if they wanted to, they could attack mainly the countries in the region. Let's say this war breaks out and it involves South Korea and perhaps Japan. They could certainly attack South Korea and Japan. They have a limited number of ICBMs that could reach the United States. They certainly have a very large army. So if the fighting on the ground was in North Korea, they could, as they did in the Korean War, intervene there. So there's that. I think that what they would do would depend a lot on how we got to the point of having a war. If the United States just unilaterally next week says, okay, we're tired of all this, we're going to take out the nuclear capability and the government of North Korea, that is, if we initiate the use of force, I think the odds of China intervening are pretty good because, again, they don't want the American army on their border. On the other hand, if something happens and it's very, very clear that North Korea was the country that started it, I think China is much less likely to intervene, although they would still be concerned about what happens to this thing called North Korea after the war is over. I really think they'd be very concerned if there was a democratic North Korea unified with South Korea or whatever on their border.
Did you happen to see this article that Newsweek just put out about how China must prepare for war with North Korea?
Yeah, I read it a little bit. You know, if I was a Chinese military planner, I would go to the leadership and say, look, I think this is highly unlikely, but, you know, we have to be prepared. We have a long border with them. They have a certain number of missiles that we've been assuming they would use to target places in South Korea and Japan and possibly have longer range than that, but they could certainly turn them against us. So it's something, you know, that I think Chinese military planners would sort of have a degree of concern about, but I think it's a little far-fetched. It seems to me the only situation that would cause North Korea to think about or move against China is that they felt that the Chinese government was trying to get their government out of power. Again, I think the current leadership, as with the previous leadership, as with the first leadership, their number one goal is to stay in power. And anything that threatens that, they're going to try to act against. And that could be an internal threat. We've seen the current leader execute people, et cetera, for example. Whether these people were actually threats to him, I don't know. But it certainly, I think he believed that. And countries that seemed to be moving towards attacking North Korea, I think that North Korea would be very concerned about that. But I think the idea that they, you know, that they seriously contemplate going to war against China is a little bit far-fetched.
I would have to agree with you. And I think one of the things about this is just that kind of what I was saying at the beginning, there's this sort of mystery that goes along. It's such an insular country. It's such a, in some ways, it seems so backwards to us. And we, even right down to the funny stuff, which is believing that he eats sawdust. And we just kind of went, yeah, of course he eats sawdust. Why wouldn't he, you know? Mm-hmm. And things like that. It's so easy to make up stuff when you can't see in the dark. And that's kind of what it seems to be we're doing here in the world, is sort of with North Korea, sort of stumbling around in the dark looking for a light switch. So I'm curious, though, do you think that we are actually heading for a war, or are we doomed to live in this sort of tenuous peace where it's just the absence of a war that hasn't started yet?
I think it's much more likely it will be the latter. That is, that through time there will be a series of things that North Korea does that we basically have to respond to, I mean, not by going to war, but by telling them, no, don't do that, or moving forces around. Again, probably things that involve North Korea taking acts that threaten our friends in the region more than threaten us. But, you know, I think this is kind of business as usual between the United States and North Korea. And it's been going on since, you know, the Korean War, you know, technically it never officially ended. There was no peace treaty or anything. But since the fighting for the Korean War stopped, you know, that we've just seen this stuff off and on through time. What's different now is not necessarily, in my opinion, that this newish leader is just completely different from his father and his grandfather, but they're more advanced. I mean, his grandfather may have gone to bed every night wishing he had nuclear weapons, but at that point in time, they did not possess the ability to build these things. They now do possess the ability to build them. So their ability, their industrialization, et cetera, has moved forward, which means they can do things that threaten us more than they could 20 or 30 years ago. But I see much more continuity in their behavior towards us and towards their neighbors and our friends than discontinuity.
Well, I will say I think the future is anything but boring when it comes to this. I've been talking with Dr. Richard Stoll, Albert Thomas Professor of Political Science at Rice University in Houston. Dr. Stoll, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Convo is a production of KETR-FM in Commerce, Texas. Production and logo design by Scott Morgan. Music by Eric the Ninja. Additional episodes of Convo are available at ketr.org. You can support this program and others like it by visiting ketr.org and clicking Donate.